Our gospel reading continues from John chapter 20, picking up with verse 26. A week has passed since Jesus appeared to the disciples. A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." And Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Because blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name. There ends the reading. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The 20th chapter of John begins with a locked room. It's dark outside, and the curtains are drawn, and the lights are down low, and John says they were hiding away from the mob that had demanded Jesus' death. But of course, it's bigger than that. It's easy to forget that Easter was not a triumphant moment for the disciples, but rather a bewildering one, because they had hoped. They had hoped. They had dared to imagine a world where death was not inevitable. They had imagined a world that was not governed by power players and state-sponsored terror. They had dared to dream, and then they watched those dreams die on the cross. See, to hope is to open your heart. To hope is to make yourself vulnerable to disappointment. So when that disappointment arrived for the disciples, it was crushing. So crushing, in fact, that they could not bring themselves to believe the stories of the women when they ran back breathless with rumors of resurrection. "Oh, fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice, shame on me," they might have said. And so they withdrew, they hid away, and they locked the doors. Now, if you're not familiar with that kind of wound-licking, face-saving hiding place, then maybe you've never really had your heart broken. If we wanted to put it in structural terms, we could call it the architecture of doubt, that place where we retreat to feel safe in the face of uncertainty. It's not giving up exactly, but it's not a step of faith. It is somewhere in between, something like a waiting room. I read a reflection this week by an Anglican priest that challenged the way that I think about the empty tomb. He argues that if the cross is the central symbol of Christianity representing Jesus' death, then surely the empty tomb is the central symbol of the resurrection representing Jesus' life. "We were just there last week. The one you seek is not here," said the men in dazzling white to Mary and her friends. "He is not here. He is risen." And Peter needed an even closer look. He ran all the way into the space, marveling at the empty darkness, the linens crumpled on the ground. And it's very interesting to me that the initial counts of the resurrection are about Jesus' absence. The first indication of good news was not the presence of the risen Lord, but the absence of a corpse. And for a long time, a week in this account, the disciples lived in that in-between place between knowing and not knowing. So I'm not surprised, really, that we gravitate towards the empty tomb as our preferred icon of the resurrection. So much of our faith life is like a religious CSI episode. We move through the world with a magnifying glass and a chemistry set, seeking evidence of the holy. Was Jesus here? How recently? Who witnessed it? We sift through contradictory information, we take testimonies, we seek solid ground on which to place our feet. And all too often, as bad as we would like to claim and celebrate the resurrection as a walking, talking, death-destroying miracle, we like to hedge our bets a little bit, returning again to the empty tomb. It's a safer bet, even on the level of metaphor. It is the architecture of our doubt. Christ is not here, we say, agreeing with the men. We know that for sure. But is he risen? We are looking into that. In the meantime, the empty tomb is our in-between place, our safe place. And I don't want you to hear me wrong here. I think that doubt is a feature, not a flaw, of our postmodern religious life. Like it or not, we are living in a world where people are inherently suspicious of certainty and absolute truth with some very good reasons. Really, we are just now correcting for centuries of history that valued certainty above everything else. And you know, in many congregations today, the best way to preach Doubting Thomas would be to make a case for doubt, to point out Christ's compassion for the disciples and Thomas in particular, to ask people to identify their doubts and, like Thomas, to bravely say them out loud, to be patient with themselves, to ask what their doubts are telling them about themselves. This is important work, and I'm sure that there are many of us who need to do that. But on the other hand, we are not most congregations. We are Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church. This is a special place. Doubting is what we do best. You might even call it our spiritual gift. So I asked myself this week, what is God's word to Brown Memorial from this text? Because this church has long been a home for people who have been burned, for people with questions, for people with considerable doubts. It is an honor, in fact, to be that place. I am a member of your tribe, Brown Memorial. And if this is our in-between place, our waiting room, if this is the architecture of our doubt, it is lovely. And indeed, that may be part of the problem, because I believe that it is possible to be too comfortable in your certainty. But I believe that it is also possible to be too comfortable in your doubt. Rachel Held Evans grew up in Dayton, Tennessee. Dayton is a small town with a big history. It was the site of the famous Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. If you need to brush up on your history, here is the quick and dirty version. Tennessee passed a law in the 1920s making it illegal to teach the theory of evolution to high school students. There was a fear that teaching children about evolution would introduce doubt into their minds about the authority of Scripture. And three-time presidential candidate and lifelong Presbyterian William Jennings Bryan supported the bill. And in my mind, he sounds something like Kevin Spacey in House of Cards when he said to the reporters, "The Christian parents of this state owe this law a debt of gratitude for saving their children from the poisonous influence of an unproven hypothesis." Now, Bryan ended up prosecuting the case himself, which turned into a media circus about fundamentalist Christianity, with witness being asked questions on the stand like, "Can you explain how Eve was created from a rib?" Or, "Did Cain have to marry his own sister?" Now, this was the first trial ever broadcast in its entirety on the radio. This was OJ before OJ, if OJ was Charles Darwin. Scopes was convicted in the end. He never had denied, after all, that he had taught evolution to his students. But Christianity lost its trial in the media. That is Dayton, Tennessee, and to be honest with you, it hadn't changed too much when Rachel Held Evans was born there in 1981. She was the child of a theology professor. She was a conservative Christian evangelical, which is to say she was like almost everyone else in Dayton, Tennessee. She went to Bryan College, right in Dayton, named after William Jennings Bryan. And she writes of her faith in those days, "For most of my life, I interpreted everything that happened around me and within me as an act of God. God was the only explanation for how the world came to be, how people managed to be good to each other, how believers had religious experiences, how all things worked together for good." This Christian worldview, she says, was kind of like that duck that you have printed on the cover of your bulletin. The duck was her guide. The duck explained the universe. And then one day, she says, she saw the rabbit. "It happened rather suddenly, and it startled me," she writes, "in one shocking moment, just as clearly as I could see the duck, I could see another pattern that explained the world: chance, wishful thinking, self-delusion, self-centeredness, superstition, fear, projection, science, psychology, coincidence, power plays, and politics." If you haven't already realized it, the image on your bulletin is an illusion. It's a double image. It can be read left to right as a duck, and most people do see the duck first, but it can also be read right to left as a rabbit. The duck's beak become the rabbit's ears. And here's the key insight from Held Evans, I think. "It's not that I stopped seeing the duck," she says. "It's just that once I saw the rabbit, I couldn't not see them both. I saw the picture made sense both ways." Now, I love that double image as a metaphor for the life of faith and doubt. We read the world constantly through multiple contradictory lenses, and it's the reason why our CSI-style investigations always seem to fall short of proving the holy. It's the reason why you can't prosecute yourself into a deeper understanding of God or build a child's faith by repressing their questions. It's because the evidence that points us towards God is the exact same evidence that points us away from God. The life story that has brought you joy and friendship has also delivered you pain and disappointment. This is not a zero-sum game. The duck and the rabbit are the same drawing. It is not a matter of choosing the right one. It is a matter of learning to live with double vision. It's a matter of leaning into mystery. Which brings us back to Thomas. I really enjoy the fact that Thomas had the nickname Didymus, or the twin. I call him T. Diddy for short. Now, did he have a twin? Who knows? The Bible doesn't say, but I like to think of Thomas the twin struggling with this double vision. Now, let's be clear. This is just me having fun with the text. But Thomas had known Jesus for years. He had seen the miracles in person. He was seated at the Last Supper, and he had heard Jesus at least three times describe his own imminent death and resurrection. Thomas had a long, good look at Jesus, better than any of us, and he still already had faith. He had already left behind everything to follow him. But he couldn't help but see the rabbit. He still found himself undone with fear and disappointment and doubt when he found that he couldn't see Jesus with his own eyes. When he was confronted with that dilemma, he did two things that I think are familiar to a lot of us. He demanded more evidence, and he locked himself away. He retreated into the architecture of his doubt. In the end, Jesus does show up for Thomas. He does offer up his wounds for Thomas to inspect. And interestingly, though the text doesn't mention whether Thomas ever actually takes him up on the offer, I would like to think that once he set eyes on Jesus' face, it seemed like a crude and irrelevant request. So, friends, what is the word today for Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church? Do we need to cease our doubting ways? Do we need to find a new spiritual gift? I don't think so. Doubt is an integral part of our spirituality. We are right to embrace it and explore it. We don't need to be ashamed, and we don't need to pretend to be certain. In fact, please stop pretending to be certain. It's very annoying. But doubt should also never be our end game. It can become its own form of paralysis. Jesus didn't vacate the empty tomb so that we could take up permanent residence there. Jesus is calling us to step out in faith. "As the Father has sent me," he said, "so I send you." That is an invitation we can never fully be ready for, and Jesus is asking us to do it anyway. I guess to the extent that we find that scary, it's bad news. But there is also good news. It's packed concisely into the very first verse of our reading today. "When it was evening on that first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples were hiding were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.'" We think of John 3:16 as the encapsulation of the gospel, but I would also like to offer up John 20:19. "Jesus was gone, the disciples were heartbroken, and they locked themselves away. But the architecture of their doubt did not stop Jesus from coming and standing with them." See, this is not the story of the triumph of faithful people. This is not the story of monks in the desert who, upon their 30th hour of consecutive prayer, began to levitate off the ground. This is not the story of Mother Teresa dedicating her entire life to the lepers of Calcutta. This is the story where a bunch of guys, when it came down to it, were too scared to believe in Jesus, and Jesus shows up anyway. Not to wrap their faithless knuckles with rulers, but to hold up his own scarred palms and say, "Peace be with you." And here's the crazy thing. The text seems to suggest that it was not the evidence in the end that swayed them. It was not Exhibit A, Jesus' beating heart, that closed the case for them. No, it was his wounds. Verse 20, after seeing this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples rejoiced to see the Lord. It was his woundedness that showed them that the promises of the gospel are true. It was his love. Thomas gets a bad rap. We call him Doubting Thomas, but the Christian tradition holds that he traveled from Israel to India talking about Jesus with anyone that would listen. And the tradition says that he died a martyr's death, demonstrating both bravery and love until the end of his life. But I think we fool ourselves to paint Thomas as a man who stopped doubting the day that Jesus invited him to touch the wounds. That is just a retreat into more binary thinking about doubt and certainty, and I don't think that is helpful. I think it's much more reasonable to think of him as a human being like ourselves, someone who learned to embrace double vision, someone who learns that our life is both joy and pain, and it is very hard to have one without the other. Someone who took that knowledge, scary as it is, and opened the doors of his heart one more time, trusting that he would be accompanied in that place by another. Trusting that when he finally did find the courage to hold out his hand, it would be grasped by another scarred palm.